You are listening to Living for the Cinema with Jeff Gershon. Welcome to the Living for the Max series. Over the past 45 years, there's been no other film franchise quite as inventive nor as consistently exciting as the Mad Max saga. Directed by Australian cinematic genius George Miller, they have each reflected his unique vision while also being hugely influential on pop culture, most specifically the action genre. Therefore, over the next several months, I will be revisiting each entry of this beloved franchise every month, leading up to the U.S. release of Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, on May 24th. Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, which came out in 1985 and was co-directed by George Miller and George Ogilvy. It stars Mel Gibson, Tina Turner, Helen Boudet, Bruce Spence, Angela Rosito, Adam Cockburn, Frank Thring, Paul Larson, Angry Anderson, Robert Grubb, George Spartels, and Edward Hodgman. The genre would be post-apocalyptic action thriller.
What are you trading?
I'm looking for someone.
You got anything to trade or not?
I got skills, I can trade them.
Next! Perhaps you've got something to trade after all.
Today is necessary to kill a man. What do you say?
Okay, you said a fair fight. What do you mean by that?
Thunderdome.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time's here.
No, it's not as action-packed, nor as tightly made as The Road Warrior, but there is still a special place in my heart for what I believe is the only film in this franchise that isn't R-rated, and also co-stars the late, great Tina Turner.
The desert sun, every step that you take could be your final one. In the burning heat, hanging on the edge of destruction. You can't stop the pain of your children crying out in your head. They always said that the living would envy the dead.
She's a big reason I dig this movie so much. Besides providing two killer songs for the soundtrack, Turner is having a good time chewing the scenery as Auntie.
But he's just a raggedy man.
He's quick.
And Bob, you think he can do it?
Maybe.
And what did you do before this?
I was a cop, a driver.
But how the world turns. One day cock of the walk, next to feather dust. Play something tun-tun, something tragic. Do you know who I was? Nobody. Except on the day after, I was still alive. This nobody had a chance to be somebody.
The sort of villain of this piece, clad in a silver dress, along with impressive oversized metal hoop earrings, who runs the bustling little post-apocalyptic methane-powered metropolis known as Bartertown, which is also home to the titular Thunderdome. The whole dystopian desert town setup is really quite inventively designed by Graham Walker and Annie Browning. Their creative work is definitely one of the highlights for this film. Everything feels grungy and lived in, but with some flair thrown in. For example, Auntie's apartment slash office is pretty wild, as it seems to be walled mostly by curtains. It overlooks the rest of Bartertown, and even has a special ski lift-like throne for her, which goes down directly to Thunderdome. And it's just before we actually get to Thunderdome where the story really takes off. Mel's Max has made a deal with Auntie to challenge to a fight the main brains and brawn behind what powers Bartertown. Hint, it's related to pigs and excrement.
Call it Underworld.
It's what Buttertown gets its energy.
What, oil, natural gas?
Pigs.
You mean pigs like those?
That's right.
Bullshit.
Pig shit.
What?
Pig shit. The lights, the motors, the vehicles, all run by a high-powered gas called methane.
I'm talking about Master Blaster. Well, actually, Max is only fighting Blaster.
I see a big guy giving a little guy a piggyback.
Master Blaster. They're a unit. They even share the same name.
The little one is called Master. He's the brains. He runs Underworld. The other one is Blaster. He's the muscle. Together, they can be very powerful.
Basically, Max finds himself in the middle of an energy dispute, as Auntie wants him to dispense with Blaster so that she can better control Master. The conflict never gets as visceral as what George Miller did with The Road Warrior, but that's okay because Miller and co-director George Ogilvy, who helped take things over at points during the production when Miller was actually dealing with an unexpected personal tragedy, Ogilvy really has other ideas than to just give us a straightforward action picture. He also wants to tell us a fable about how someone can find and maintain hope amidst a bleak future, along with the power of myths and how they spread through time. And this takes us to the extended, slower midsection of the movie, which has clearly divided and/or disappointed fans since day one. Max finds himself among a tribe of mostly children, led by a couple of teenagers, living in the one apparent freshwater lagoon, isolated amidst a never-ending array of dry, punishing desert. I think these kids are meant to remind us of Peter Pan's Lost Boys, as most of them are quite cheery. They're basically living in the closest this world has to paradise, and they don't even realize it. This tribe is on the search for the mysterious Captain Walker, whom they mistakenly believe to be Max at first when they first meet him. Scrounged from a collection of pre-nuclear war modern artifacts, including a viewfinder, an old vinyl record, and various pictures of this Walker, along with a large abandoned passenger plane nearby. They have crafted a historical record of this man who they believe survived the apocalypse and will come to them one day to fly them away back to their mysterious home known as Tomorrow Morrowland.
Remember this?
Tomorrow Morrowland!
Remember this?
The Year of Light!
Remember this?
Skyland!
Remember this?
Then Captain Walker picked them a village, and good for a long haul. They counted 20, and that with them, the great leaving. They said bye-bye to them what they'd birthed, and from out of the nothing, they looked back, and Captain Walker hollered, "Wait, one of us will come."
Wait, one of us will come.
And somebody did come.
Sure, everyone talks in a weird sort of hybrid English gibberish, and the kids are mostly quite plucky. And I'm sure to a lot of Mad Max diehards, these kids are basically this franchise's version of the Ewoks, which I can understand. But what really makes it work for me is how Max retains his hard edge, even after eventually staying with this tribe for a while.
You slog out there to nothing!
Worse than nothing. The first place you'll find is a sleaze pit called Bartertown. Now, if the Earth doesn't swallow you up first, that place sure as hell will.
And from there, the climax, which is basically them escaping from Bartertown with their train. I think it holds up as an effectively staged extended action set piece. It's basically a fleet of creatively designed marauding cars chasing alongside a high-speed one-car train which houses our heroes. The stunt work is impressive, as are the pyrotechnics. But no, this climax is not nearly the showstopper as the ones before or after this movie. And I think that's okay, because the film really does end on a genuinely haunting, bittersweet note as we see where this tribe's journey finally takes them.
But most of all, we members the man who finded us. Him that came the salvage. And we lights the city. Not just for him, but for all of them that are still out there. Because we knows there'll come a night when they seize the distant light and they'll be coming home.
And at the very end, we also just see Max once again aimlessly wandering off into the desert as a true survivor. Only 30 years later, he would eventually transform into Tom Hardy. And this brings us to the categories. And because this is the Living for the Max series, we have the first category, which is the moment of madness. From the get-go, the Mad Max series has become widely known for jaw-dropping action sequences, often made possible by death-defying stunt work. And the moment of madness would be the best demonstration of that for this particular entry in the Mad Max saga. Quite simply, two men enter, one man leaves.
Two men enter, one man leaves.
Yes, of course, it has to be the Thunderdome face-off between Blaster and Max. And it's quite the fun matchup, too, to witness as we see our two opponents go at it as a packed crowd gathers around every inch of the outside of this giant steel cage. The whole sequence is impressively directed by George Miller, as he certainly knows his way around effective action sequences. What sets this one apart from past Mad Max scrape-ups is the bungee work. Seeing Gibson flipping up and down within this cramped arena surrounded on all sides by steel and spikes and angry onlookers, it's a genuine kick. The next category would be the best needle drop. This is the best song cue or piece of score used throughout the runtime of the film, because music is essential to film. And this is simply a no-brainer, as what really nails the conclusion for this movie, for me, is the kickoff during the credits of what I believe to still be the best soundtrack song from a decade which was loaded with iconic soundtracks. Yes, I'm talking about We Don't Need Another Hero, from Ms. Turner, of course. I just love it all. The mid-tempo synth beat, the saxophone, the simple guitar hook that we hear between lyrics, just a great effing song, which really nails the themes of this movie.
We are the children, the last generation. We are the ones they left behind.
Few things can even top the power of hearing Turner belt out just before the bridge.
Is it all or nothing?
The next category would be wasted talent. This is the most underutilized talent involved with the film. Now, I would say that one disappointing aspect of this movie are the general overall villains, possibly besides Tina Turner's auntie. This time around, we have these marauders chasing Max and gang, but they're a bit of a mixed bag, more so than the previous movie. Now, Turner, of course, plays good villain, but just the way her character is written does not actually provide much in the way of actual menace for Max. And same with her main henchman, Iron Bar, who is often wittily portrayed by Angry Anderson. Yes, that's the actor's real name, Angry Anderson.
Iron Bar, you think you can do it?
Maybe.
I mean, he's fun to watch for sure, but towards the end of the climax, he actually comes off more as a relentless cartoon character along the lines of the Roadrunner, rather than a real threat to our protagonists. Just could have used a little more. The next category would be the trailer moment. This is the scene or moment that best describes this movie. Okay, now this is a small one, which occurs barely 10 minutes into the movie, but I just love it, as it pretty much epitomizes Max as a character.
1 hour.
Do you find him? What then?
I'll ask him to return what's mine.
Oh, and of course he'll be desperate to clear his conscience.
He will be.
You that good?
Mm-hmm.
He has just negotiated his way into Barter Town to have a meet with Auntie. But before he can be allowed to enter this town, he needs to stop by a special walk-up window to relinquish all of his weapons. And yeah, not only the visuals of various sorts of weaponry besides the standard pistols, shells, or shotguns. I don't know, there's one long metallic device I can't tell if it's some kind of pickaxe or maybe an early 80s version of the club used to secure steering wheels in cars. But regardless, what really sells this moment as much as the glare on Max's face biting down while laying these out is the sound design.
Leave your weapons here, it's the law.
And this brings me to the final category, the MVP. This is the person or people who are most responsible for the success of this film. Now, Max has always been a character of few words, and Gibson plays him effectively as only Gibson can, with those darting eyes and brutish charisma. He has made this an iconic character, even without a tagline or central story to carry him through, which is no small feat. And here's the thing about this particular entry in the saga, though I'm sure many fans will disagree. I believe that this is the best performance we have seen of this character from an acting standpoint. Now, I'm not taking anything away from Gibson's other performances in other films or Tom Hardy's mostly silent performance in Fury Road, but within this particular story, Max/Gibson is just given more to do. More emotion, more dialogue, more interplay with the rest of the cast. It's actually in this movie where we get to really see Mel Gibson's movie star persona not only truly take hold, I mean this was just a couple of years before he first played Riggs in Lethal Weapon, but we genuinely experience a real arc for this character. Now granted, that general arc of Max shifting from cynical observer slash survivor towards willing participant slash selfless warrior, yes, it was also this character's general arc in both Road Warrior and Fury Road. But it's in this movie, the third movie, where the camera truly spends the most time not only on Max's face, but we get to listen more to how he talks. His reaction to being told the story of Captain Walker is quite brutish, but also disarmingly human.
Now listen good. I'm not Captain Walker. I'm the guy that keeps Mr. Dead in his pocket. And I say we're gonna stay here. And we're gonna live a long time. And we're going to be thankful. Right?
For delivering what I believe is the best lead performance of the entire Mad Max saga, Mel Gibson is the MVP. My rating for Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome would be 4.5 stars out of 5. Is this the best Mad Max film? Well, from an overall quality standpoint, probably not. This movie is just not as tight nor as visceral as parts 2 and 4. But me personally, it remains my overall favorite. And if you're looking to watch Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, it is now streaming on Apple TV. And that ends another Raggedy Man review. Please like, subscribe, and share the Living for the Cinema podcast. And follow and like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Letterboxd. And join us next time for another review from Living for the Cinema.